Every Monday from 6 to 8 on CFRC. Every Monday from 6 to 8 on CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. You never know what you're gonna get. CFRC's most varied variety show. You never know what you're gonna get. You never know what you're gonna get. CFRC's most varied variety show. Hosted by your friends Mike and Chance. No static. No static. CFRC 101.9 FM. CFRC.ca. CFRC.ca/no_static.
Welcome back to Melodies of Myth, where we explore short historical tales blended through music and culture. I'm your host, Simar Kaur, and I am so glad that you're here. On this show, we usually move between traditions and time periods, tracing how stories travel and how melodies carry meaning. But every so often, we step slightly outside the expected map and follow a different kind of music. One that isn't written by composers or performed on a stage. A kind of music that exists anyway, whether we notice it or not. Tonight's story is about that. About listening for what most people never think to listen for. And what happens when you realize the world has its own frequencies, its own hidden harmonies? It's set far north under a sky that doesn't need an audience, and it follows someone who discovers a sound that belongs to no one, but can still be shared with care, of course. So settle in, take a breath, and let the silence do some of the work. Here is The Frequency Nobody Owned. The first time Tessa heard the Northern Lights, she thought it was a glitch. It was 1:43 a.m. in Yellowknife, and the cold had that special kind of confidence, like it could convince your eyelashes to quit. Tessa stood on the porch of her rental boots, squeaking on packed snow, phone camera already open like proof mattered more than experience. Above her, the sky was doing what it did up here when it decided to show off. Green ribbons, pale and bright, unspooling across the dark like someone had dragged a brush through ink. She lifted her phone. The screen tried to translate it into pixels. It failed in the unusual way, flattening something huge into something shareable. Then her headphones crackled. A thin, wavering sound slipped into her ears like a distant whistle being pulled sideways by wind. It rose, dipped, returned. Not music exactly, not static either. More like the sky was trying to speak in a language that the radio could barely hold. Tessa lowered the phone and stared at the device clipped to her coat. a small receiver she'd bought secondhand, the kind that picked up very low-frequency signals, VLF, used by hobbyists, researchers, and the type of person who found comfort in invisible patterns. She had brought it north as a joke at first, a personal object, a way to make the winter feel less like a wall, and now she stood there, breath-fogging, listening to the aurora sing. She didn't move for a long time, not because she was afraid to break something, but because she finally understood what her old sound design professor used to say in that maddening but calm tone. He said, "If you're lucky, the world will offer you a sound that doesn't belong to anyone." The next morning, in the bright blue hush that passes for daylight up here, Tessa carried her gear to the community radio station. It was a small building tucked between practical things, a co-op, a snowbank that had given up pretending it would melt soon, and a notice board that always seemed to have the same four flyers. Lost mittens, used skates, a fundraiser, a handwritten warning about a loose dog that had become a local legend. Anyway, inside, the station smelled like instant coffee and warm electronics. Heaven, if you ask me. Anyway, a woman at the front desk looked up. "You must be the new audio tech." Tessa nodded. "Marla," the woman said, already going back to her laptop like names were an efficient exchange and not a ceremony. "Your key fob's on the hook. Studio B is haunted, but only a little." Tessa smiled, unsure if Marla was joking. Up here, people spoke in deadpan the way some places spoke in exclamation points. She walked down a narrow hallway lined with old posters. Local bands, town halls, climate meetings, radio fund drives with slogans that age in the exact way slogans always did, seeming familiar. She paused in front of one that said, "Listen like it matters." It made her chest tighten, annoyingly. In Studio B, she set her bag down and pulled off the VLF receiver like it was a secret. The room was small, carpeted, soundproofed in that slightly tired way, and the microphone on the desk looked like it had heard a thousand shy voices become braver. She plugged in a recorder and listened back to last night's audio. The aurora came through again, wavering tones, shifting harmonies, tiny bursts like distant sparks. Underneath it all, a bed of quiet that felt less like silence and more like space, wide and indifferent and somehow gentle. Tessa leaned closer to the waveform on her laptop as if she could find the sky in the shape of it. She was supposed to be editing ads for a local hardware store. She was supposed to be learning the station's schedule. She was supposed to be doing her job. Instead, she made a new folder and named it Aurora_takes, like it was already an archive. At lunch, she asked Marla about it, trying to sound casual. She said, "Do people here talk about the lights like they make noise?" She said, stirring powdered soup in a paper cup. Marla raised an eyebrow. "You mean the old Aurora crackles thing?" "People swear they hear it. People swear they don't. People swear a lot up here. Doesn't make it fake." Tessa hesitated. "I recorded something last night," and Marla said, "With what?" And she pulled the small retriever out of her pocket and placed it on the counter like an offering. Marla's mouth tilted into something like approval. "Oh, you're that kind of a nerd." Respectfully, Tessa said, "Yes." Marla tapped the device once with a fingernail. "If you have audio, you should bring it to Ellie." Now, who is Ellie? Marla nodded towards the back room. "A resident everything. he'll either tell you it's brilliant or tell you it's cursed. Eddie turned out to be a man in his late 60s and silver hair that looked like it had been cut by someone who didn't believe in fuss. He wore headphones even when nothing was playing, like he wanted to be ready. He listened without interrupting as Tessa explained the whole receiver thing, and then she played the audio. Ellie's face didn't change much, but his eyes did. They softened. And when the clip ended, he lifted one headphone cup off his ear like he needed air. "That," he said, "is worth something." He gave her a look that suggested she'd taken the wrong question. "It is recorded, and that's not the same thing as real?" Tessa asked. Ellie leaned back. "Real is complicated, but recorded means that you can share it without stealing it." Tessa frowned. "Without stealing it?" Ellie nodded toward the window, where the snow sat like it owned the world. "Everything up here gets taken eventually. Stories, resources, images, souvenirs. People come north, collect what they want, then leave. You're holding something that doesn't belong to you, and you still want to make something with it. And that is where people mess up." "I'm just saying, if you're going to put it on air, you do it carefully." And that night, Tessa did not sleep much. Not because she was excited, not exactly, more because her brain kept circling the same thought like it was trying to land. What does it mean to share a sound that nobody owns? She thought of all the ways people use the North as a mood board. The dramatic photos, the mystical captions, the subtle feeling of distance turned into aesthetic. She didn't want to do that. She wanted to do something quieter, something closer to listening than claiming. So she built a segment, piece by piece, like a careful room. She kept it simple. No big declarations, no ancient magic, no pretending she'd unlocked a secret of the universe with a secondhand device and a lucky night. And so she wrote a script that was mostly questions. What are you hearing when you hear the sky? What changes when you listen for something you can't see? What do you do with wonder once you've caught it? She layered the Aurora audio beneath her voice like a tide. She added field recordings from the town, snow crunching under boots, a door closing against the wind, the faint hum of a street light, the distant bark of a dog that sounded like it was arguing with the cold. She almost added music, soft synth pads, something cinematic, but she stopped herself. The Aurora did not need accompaniment. It was already doing too much. At 7:55 p.m., she walked into Studio A for her first on-air piece. Marla was there, leaning against the wall, pretending she didn't care. Ellie sat in the corner with his arms crossed, looking like a judge and a guardian at the same time. And Tessa adjusted the mic. Her hands shook once, then steadied. The red on-air light flickered on, and she spoke. "Good evening. This is Northern Community Radio, and I am Tessa. Tonight, I want to share something I recorded outside last night, something the sky was doing when it thought nobody was listening." She kept her voice calm, not dramatic, like she was inviting the audience into a small and private truth. And then she played the Aurora. The tones filled the studio, thin, wavering, and strange. Not pretty in the usual way, not clean, but alive. And Tessa watched the board levels like they were the only safe thing to look at. She listened for errors, for clipping, for anything that would turn the moment into a technical failure. Instead, the audio held. Her script followed quietly. "This isn't the Aurora that your camera sees. This is the Aurora the way a receiver hears it, electromagnetic signals translated into sound. It's not a song exactly, it's a trace, a reminder that the world is always speaking, even when it does not speak to us. She paused, letting the aurora breathe. I am not here to tell you what it means. I think meanings change depending on who is listening and why they're listening. But I will tell you this. When was the last time you listened to something that didn't ask you to respond? Something that did not want your opinion, your post, your attention, rather, just your presence. She let the next aurora clip run longer than radio usually allowed. In the station, nobody moved, and when the segment ended, the red light went dark. There was a stretch of silence that felt respectful, like the room did not want to be the first to interrupt the sky. Ellie stood up slowly, as if his joints needed time to agree with his pride. "You didn't narrate over it," he said. "I almost did," Tessa admitted, "but you didn't." Ellie repeated, and this time it sounded like approval. After the broadcast, Tessa checked the station inbox. There were already messages. Some were practical, such as, "What equipment do you use?" Some were curious, "Is that what satellites sound like?" And some were unexpectedly tender, like, "My dad used to talk about hearing the lights. I did not believe him until tonight." One message was just a sentence, no name attached. It said, "Thank you for not making it into a joke." And Tessa stared at that sentence for quite a long time. She hadn't known that what she was trying to do, avoid turning it into a joke, but it was true. The world was already full of people flattening things into entertainment. She didn't want to be another set of hands pressing wonder into something small enough to carry away. And later that week, she found herself back outside at night, receiver clipped to her coat, breath turning into clouds that felt temporary and honest. Unfortunately, the aurora did not show, but the receiver picked up a faint noise. Tessa did not feel disappointed. That surprised her. Instead, she felt steadier, like she had learned something useful and unflashy, that you couldn't demand the extraordinary. You could only make yourself available to it. At the end, she smiled. Thinking back to the moments, not because she had captured something, not because she could package it into a segment or post it with the right caption, just because, for a second, the world reminded her it was bigger than ever, and she was still allowed to be part of it, simply by paying attention. She stayed outside until the cold began to insist. When she finally turned to go back in, the sky remained dark and quiet, keeping its secrets without cruelty. And Tessa walked indoors, feeling strangely full, like she had eaten a meal made of silence and signal, and for once, that was enough.
Shattered the hope and ran to cope, no right. God, what
That was Human, an original track of mine, and I played it tonight because it fits the mood of this episode. Quiet, reflective, and a little bit in between. For me, this song is about slowing down long enough to feel what you usually rush past. And remembering that being human is allowed to be messy, soft, and honest. If it resonated with you, thank you for listening, and feel free to reach out with your thoughts on my Instagram at melodiesofmyth_CFRC. But let's continue forward.
Just like children sleeping, we could dream this night away. But there's a full moon rising, let's go. 'cause I'm still in love with you.
Brings us to the end of tonight's episode of Melodies of Myth. Thank you for spending this time with me and for letting the story and the music sit with you for a little while. If there's only thing I hope you take from this evening, it's this. Listening can be an act of care. Not just listening to songs, but listening to the people around you. To the quiet details, to the feelings we usually rush past. Sometimes the most meaningful moments are the ones that don't ask us to be explained, only noticed. As you head back into the rest of your afternoon / evening, I hope you carry a bit of that softness with you, whether you are walking home, studying late, or just taking a moment to breathe. This has been Melodies of Myth with me, Simar Kaur. And if you enjoyed tonight's episode, feel free to reach out, share it with a friend, or send in a song suggestion for a future show on my Instagram at melodiesofmyth_CFRC. And until next Friday at 3 p.m., take care of yourself, stay curious, and keep listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Vai marinheiro, vai, vai, vai buscar a Laurindinha. Vai marinheiro, vai, vai, ela é tua, não é minha. Sim, nosso é. Com toda a certeza, o programa Atlantis, que transmitimos dos estúdios da CFRC no quadrante 101.9 FM, em sistema de cabo 90.9, aos domingos das 18 às 20 horas, com locução de Eduardo Pereira.
Vai, marinheiro, vai, vai, vai buscar.
Hey, this is Laura Jane Grace from Against Me, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
I think all trans people need to realize there's a lot of mythology out there, and some of it's perpetuated by out-of-date things that are on the internet. I just think that it's helpful to really actually know your history. It was thought of as a mental illness because people could not understand how a man might feel like a woman. They must be crazy.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Caribbean High Court tosses St. Lucia's anti-queer sex laws, Cuba allows legal gender change without surgery, and Jameson Green tracks the history of transgender medicine. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
Mm-hmm. I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm Melanie Keller.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 2nd, 2025. The laws prohibiting same-gender sex in St. Lucia are unconstitutional, according to a July 29th ruling by the Eastern Caribbean Supreme Court. The island nation's old British colonial laws called it gross indecency and buggery, and if convicted, a person could get up to 10 years in prison. As a statement from the UK-based Human Dignity Trust explained to the Associated Press, the mere existence of these laws are a violation of human rights and underpin further acts of discrimination. That was true even though the government was not enforcing them. Lawsuits were filed in 2019 seeking to strike down St. Lucia's laws and similar ones in Antigua, Barbuda, Barbados, Grenada, and St. Kitts and Nevis by the Eastern Caribbean Alliance for Diversity and Equality. ECAID suits have been successful everywhere except Grenada. The Regional High Court is based in St. Lucia's capital city of Castries, and ECAID's executive director, Kenita Placid, told This Way Out that the lawsuit there was built on cases challenging anti-LGBTQ laws in other British Commonwealth nations.
The case in Belize referenced the case in India. We had learnings from the case in Botswana and Kenya. It came back to the case in Trinidad and Tobago. There were lessons learned from cases out of Jamaica. So I think it really took a global approach in terms of understanding what had transpired in different cases across the globe and thinking about how can we do this for us.
Placid will be our guest on the next of This Way Out, exploring the growing movement for LGBTQ rights in the Caribbean with reporter David Hunt. The Dominica decriminalized queer sex last year, but it was recently recriminalized in the nation of Trinidad and Tobago when an appeals court overturned a 2018 ruling. Guyana also still outlaws private consensual adult same-gender sex. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights issued a decision in 2021 ordering Jamaica to repeal its colonial-era sodomy law, but the government has failed to follow through. The Jamaican Supreme Court ruling in 2023 rejected a gay man's challenge to those laws. A judge on St. Vincent and the Grenadines' top court dismissed two cases that challenged sodomy laws there in 2024. Now that the laws in St. Lucia have been struck down, the Australian news outlet qnews.com.au counts 64 countries around the world that still outlaw consensual adult same-gender sex.
Cuba's trans people now can legally change their gender on official government documents without the previously required surgery. The law that also amends Cuba's National Civil Registry to legally recognize common law partnerships was approved unanimously. A celebratory statement by the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association for Latin America and the Caribbean proclaimed, "Cuba advances toward equality." The island nation was the first to fully cover gender-affirming care under its healthcare system. However, access to hormone therapy medications and the necessary surgical supplies can be extremely difficult under the U.S. trade embargo. Journalist and activist Francisco Rodriguez Cruz said the changes also open the door for same-gender couple parental rights and the legal recognition of trans and intersex children. A national referendum in September 2022 opened civil marriage, adoption, and surrogacy to Cuba's same-gender couples. Argentina, Uruguay, and many other South American countries allow trans people to legally change their gender without surgical intervention. That's also true in Canada, Germany, and Malta.
Close to 100,000 people filled the streets of London to stand for existence and resistance at the Trans Plus Pride March on July 26. The theme specifically brought out many to protest the UK Supreme Court's April decision defining the words woman and sex in the Equality Act of 2010. To those with a female gender marker at birth. Organizers called it the largest such event in history an increase of 40,000 people over last year's event. This year's miles-long procession included several Palestinian flags expressing solidarity with the besieged people of Gaza. Lewis G. Burton bragged, "Our community came together to show what real strength, solidarity, and care looks like." Burton is one of London Trans Plus Pride's founders. In his words, "The message was clear. We will not be erased. Our existence is natural, historic, and enduring. You could try to take away our rights, but you will never remove us from society. We are a part of humanity, and the public will not stand by while harm is done to our community."
Berlin's Christopher Street Day Parade had tens of thousands of celebrants dancing to techno beats blaring from several floats under cloudy skies on July 26th. The LGBTQ Pride marchers happily dodged heavy rains that had poured down in previous days. Their enthusiasm was in part a protest against ruling Christian Democratic Parliament President Julia Klöckner. In May, she declared a ban on flying the rainbow flag over the Bundestag building during Pride Month because it constituted a political statement. An anti-queer counter-demonstration attended by about four dozen neo-Nazis and members of the fledgling far-right Alternative for Germany political party was quickly disbanded. The organizer and five others were arrested on their way for possession of weapons and explosives, according to the German news outlet Deutsche Presse Agentur. Berlin's first Christopher Street Day Parade was held on June 30, 1979. Organizer Thomas Hoffman thinks the crowd this year exceeded previous records. He told the Associated Press, "We want to stand up for our rights together here."
Finally, Budapest Mayor Gyurgye Kereshonia was questioned by police as a suspected organizer of the banned LGBTQ Pride Parade. Up to 300,000 people thumbed their collective noses at Hungary's authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán in the capital city on June 28th. Orbán's governing party had rammed through a ban on all Pride events, calling them harmful to minors. Officials threatened to use facial recognition software to identify and fine every participant, with a special emphasis on punishing accused organizers. Kereshonia was openly defiant when the bans were announced, declaring, "Neither freedom nor love can be banned in Budapest." According to the organizers, the result was the largest Pride crowd in the nation's history. Before he entered Hungary's National Bureau of Investigations building on August 1st, the mayor told some 200 supporters that if it cannot be banned, then it cannot be punished. He pointedly wore a t-shirt featuring the capital city's coat of arms, overlaid with rainbow colors. The mayor emerged from the investigators' headquarters after a little more than an hour. He told reporters that he had been formally accused of organizing a prohibited event. He said that he provided police with a formal statement but refused to answer specific questions. If charged and convicted, Kereshonia faces up to a year in prison. He expressed optimism that national elections next year would be a chance to take Hungary back into the European path, and predicted that the charges against him would be dropped before then. Kereshonia believes that Orbán's government has been weakened by its failed efforts to ban Pride and that it no longer has any effect over people's thinking. He said that so many people had defied the government to participate in Pride because we know exactly that either we are all free together or none of us are.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, with the week ending August 2nd, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Melanie Keller. Stay healthy.
And I'm Joe Bainline. Stay safe.
There's nothing so international as a powerful idea. Hi, I'm Edmund White. While I live in Paris and have worked in many cities in the U.S., it is the overwhelming international flavor of the lesbian and gay rights movement that has proved so powerful and impressive over the past couple of decades. And one radio program, This Way Out, has been there to record, to inform, and to entertain. So please keep listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine on this station.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Saw someone unknown, wearing a mask I had long outgrown. Trapped in a role that was never mine, till the day I said this life is a fine. They told me stay the way you are, but they never saw my scars. I searched for truth inside my mind, in silence I struggle my soul to find. And I broke free, no more fear, no regret. Step by step toward my truest self, yeah. I became me, now I feel alive. This is my life, my truth, my fight.
Coming out of Belgium, that's DJ Mystique with a brand new queer anthem, I Became Me, drawn from his personal transitioning experience. His song tells a story in line with our next guest's own journey. As the backlash against trans visibility grows more rabid every day, This Way Out's David Hunt meets a trans activist turned author who's now writing the history he helped make.
There are competing narratives about transgender people. On the right, the message is simple. Gender is fixed and immutable, decided at birth. The transgender craze, as some have called it, is a new and dangerous ideology that ignores the biological reality of sex. According to this narrative, transgender people are perpetuating a fraud on themselves and on society. They simply do not exist. The problem with this narrative is not just that it's false, it's that it fails to account for the expansive expression of the human spirit.
If I could only fly, I would fly so high, I would kiss the sky, it'd be so, so right, so right, so right.
I'm David Hunt. Join me as I explore a different, more complex, and far more interesting narrative about transgender people, a narrative that's taken 8 years and nearly 800 pages to express. It's a book called A History of Transgender Medicine in the United States, From Margins to Mainstream, published by SUNY Press, that includes the voices of 42 contributing authors. It's edited by Carolyn Wolf Gould, Dallas Denny, Kyanne Lynch, and my guest for this program, Jameson Green. Green is a longtime trans author, educator, and policy advisor, and the first person in the United States to earn a PhD in law specializing in trans issues. I asked Green who the book is for.
It's for anyone who's interested in gender and interested in this history. And I think all trans people need to realize there's a lot of mythology out there, and some of it's perpetuated by out of date things that are on the internet. I just think that it's helpful to really actually know your history. And I think that there are a lot of young people these days who are desperate to know that there is a history for them, that they have ancestors.
The stories of many of those ancestors are told in the book's 21 chapters. In chapter 5, Trudy Jackson, a member of the Navajo Nation, recounts the history of gender diversity among America's indigenous communities. Jackson, who describes herself as a proud Diné Two-Spirit transgender woman of color, writes that her history has been largely neglected by scholars. Neither colonial histories nor contemporary queer theories accurately reflect my experience of race, nation, sexuality, or gender, she says. It's a challenge that's confronted trans people in the United States for generations, the challenge of visibility, of being seen and heard, of having a voice, not just in how their stories are told, but in how their lives and identities are shaped and defined by the medical profession. It hasn't been an easy journey, but it's been part of the American experience for far longer than most people know. Jameson Green explains.
The first known trans person in the United States to be medically treated would be Alan Hart, who was an MD himself. He was born and raised in Oregon and went to medical school at the University of Oregon and at Stanford, and transitioned by way of having basically asking for a hysterectomy. And he used a eugenics-based argument for that. He said, I am so extremely inverted, which is the way people described homosexuality in that time. I'm so much of an invert that it would be better if I don't reproduce. So please give me a hysterectomy. And he was successful at that. And 1917, he had a hysterectomy, and from that day forward, he lived completely as a man.
The first transgender person to gain national notoriety in the conformist 50s was Christine Jorgensen. She ignited a media firestorm in 1953, mobbed by reporters on the tarmac at New York's Idlewild Airport as she returned home from Denmark, where she had undergone one of a series of gender-affirming medical procedures. The former American GI, born George Jorgensen, was now shy, soft-spoken, and very feminine.
I was much more content with myself than I was before. There was a great trauma about me not being me, me trying to be what someone else thought I should be. After the surgery, that kind of all disappeared. My life became something else.
That was by design. In the early days of transgender medicine, the purpose of care, of hormone treatments and surgical procedures, was to make a trans person normal, and above all, straight. And that meant aligning with society's very fixed ideas about the gender binary.
They subscribed to a lot of those stereotypes, and you had to meet those stereotypes. Trans women were supposed to be, you know, Jane Fonda, and trans men were supposed to be Robert Redford, or trans women were Maureen O'Hara, and trans men were John Wayne. And they actually thought trans men didn't need any support groups because they were so macho. So they wouldn't sit for a support group and learn how to put on their shoes and this sort of thing. But trans women were encouraged to participate in support groups to learn feminine comportment.
Whoever said that's so impossible? Well, that's not supposed to go there. Doesn't know me well, 'cause I know that today holds more, yeah, so much more, so much more, yeah, so much more.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt, continuing my conversation with Jameson Green, one of the authors and editors of a new book, A History of Transgender Medicine in the United States. In the post-war America of the 1950s and 60s, transgender people were, in the eyes of the medical establishment, suffering from an illness of the mind.
It was thought of as a mental illness. because people could not understand how a man might feel like a woman. That was that. That must be. They must be crazy. The stereotypes were so rigidly driven, and so supported by spiritual teachings and by the categories that the medical establishment had created and taught over and over and over again. And it took pretty special individuals meeting trans individuals and realizing this person is not mentally ill. So what is this? And that's really how the medical establishment became interested. More and more people realized that trans people were not ill, finding each other and sharing their experience and their research with each other.
A growing grassroots movement began to take shape across the U.S. in the 1970s and 80s, fostering communities of transgender people, eager to connect with and support each other. Pioneers included Lou Sullivan, founder of an FTM, female-to-male, support group in the San Francisco Bay Area, and Steve Dane, a California high school teacher who was fired after undergoing gender-affirming surgery in 1975. Lou Sullivan, who died of AIDS complications in 1991, was a pioneer in two respects. He was both comfortably transmasculine and comfortably gay. He challenged a long-standing practice in the medical community of denying gender-affirming care to gay and bisexual people.
Lou identified as a gay man and felt himself to be a gay man from the get-go. Never was really attracted to girls when he was in a female body. Never thought of himself as a lesbian. Knew about the gay community, knew lesbians, but was only attracted to men. And the doctors told him he was not eligible for genital reconstruction because if he wanted to be with men, he should just stay a woman. But he was a gay man, and gay men are not interested in female bodies.
Green continued Sullivan's groundbreaking work by editing the FTM newsletter after Sullivan died, and by taking a leadership role in the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, where Green was instrumental in revising the standards of care that professionals follow in treating transgender people. He notes that the medical community was not always welcoming of trans perspectives in its professional deliberations.
You know, you can't have the inmates running the asylum. That was the way they maintained their authority, was by not including very many trans people. Now, ultimately, there were trans people involved in the organization who were clinicians, who were MDs. They weren't necessarily providing care for trans people, but because they were trans people themselves, they joined out of their own self-interest.
With the establishment of the first gender clinics in the U.S. in the mid-1960s, came strict treatment protocols, rules dictating who qualified for gender-affirming care. The doctors and administrators of these clinics were the gatekeepers of the system, rejecting patients for a wide variety of reasons. Among the reasons you could be rejected? If you were married, a parent, too young, too old, poor, unattractive, or physically impaired. In short, anything that affected your ability to pass in cisgender heteronormative society put gender-affirming care out of reach for you, regardless of your wishes.
In the beginning, the treatment was all about making trans people normal. And you were supposed to make up a story about your history so that if you got into a conversation with somebody about being in the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts, depending on how you were presenting, you would say the right thing. You had to have a story that supported your entire history as what you were presenting as now. And to me, to actually suggest that seems mentally unhealthy.
Ultimately, thanks to the patience and perseverance of people like Jameson Green, the lived experiences of transgender people have gained a measure of respect among medical professionals. There's more, much more, in A History of Transgender Medicine in the United States. There's a look at transgender veterans and the Veterans Health Administration, a dive into the history of trans-focused psychiatry and psychology, and chapters on research ethics, the biological underpinnings of gender identity, the history of voice and communication interventions, and the treatment of gender-diverse children. The book could hardly be more timely, with measures targeting the rights and even the existence of transgender people growing by the day. I'd like to thank Jameson Green for speaking with me for this program. Green is one of the editors and authors of A History of Transgender Medicine in the United States, From Margins to Mainstream, published by SUNY Press. Find the book online at SUNY Press, SUNY Press.edu. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
And I know that there's days I'll reinvent. And I know that you're waiting. I know that you want so much more.
Yes, there will be more of David Hunt's interview with Jameson Green coming soon to thiswayout.org. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Joe Bainline and Melanie Keller, with thanks to this week's correspondent, David Hunt. It was produced by Brian DeShazer. The Association, DJ Mystique, and Mark Robillard performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Jim Kennedy of Dayton, Ohio, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WMUU Madison, Wisconsin, 5UV Adelaide, South Australia, KRZA Alamosa, Colorado, and a wide array of community, terrestrial, and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.